Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in History, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Michael Vann, your host, but you can call me Mike. Today I'll be talking with Professor Kim Wagner, a professor of British Imperial History at Queen Mary Campus, University of London. Dr. Wagner is a prolific historian and a gifted storyteller. He's the author of several books, including Thugi, Banditry and the British in early 19th century India, Stranglers and Bandits, a historical anthology of Thugi, The Great Fear of 1857, Rumors, Conspiracies, and the Indian Uprising of 1857, and Amritsar, 1919, An Empire of Fear and the Making of a Massacre. But today we'll be talking about The Skull of Alam Beg, The Life and Death of a Rebel of 1857. Welcome to New Books in History, Kim.
Hi, Mike.
So would you please tell us a little about yourself? How did you become a historian of the Raj, the British Empire in India? And more specifically, how did you come to be a specialist in colonial violence of all things?
Well, I guess I have to thank, in the first instance, my hippie parents who took me to India when I was a baby, and then who brought me up. My hippie parents, yeah. Who then brought me up on a solid diet of British boys' novels, sort of G.A. Henty and Arthur Conan Doyle, these kind of things. And I guess that just stuck with me, and I've somehow managed to turn my childhood readings into a professional career, such as it is. So in terms of colonial violence, it's something I've gradually moved towards. My PhD, for instance, was on the phenomenon of banditry known as the Thugs, that people might know from Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom, amongst other things, which was a bit more cerebral project, which was about colonial knowledge, really. But I guess in my more recent work, I've been drawn to the kind of violence that accompanied what was ostensibly the civilizing mission. And so I'm quite fascinated by this inherent contradiction in trying to spread Western civilization, but effectively doing it at the point of the bayonet. And so often you hear stories about Western imperialism, which kind of gloss over the violence. And that's something I'm rather keen on bringing back into sort of the center of the analysis.
Mm-hmm. And what were some of your contributions regarding the Thugi or the Thug history?
Well, it's one of the most pervasive Orientalist tropes, but also one of the least understood, at least at the time. It's 20 years ago since I did my PhD on the topic. It's a bit like the study of witchcraft in an early modern European context, in the sense that the only sources that are really available are those produced by the authorities who are suppressing this particular type of Indian banditry. And so we have a quite interesting conundrum right at the heart of center of writing history. How do you write about a practice which was in some ways invented by the authorities? And is it possible to recover voices of people whom the British believe to be sort of ritual stranglers and in a sense, write something more interesting about it.
And in your previous book on 1857, you also emphasize history that's difficult to get at in terms of sourcing with the your emphasis on rumors, correct?
So rumors is one of the few ways in which we can access what might always be referred to as sort of the mentality of common people. And in a colonial context, that the silences in the archive are even more pronounced because illiterate Indian peasants didn't leave much in the way of written sources that we can work with. But you do have the colonial authorities recording rumors. And rumors are more than just distorted news or gossip. They actually give you, provide a window into popular mentalities because they reflect both people's apprehensions, but also their hopes and aspirations. And so it's an interesting way of trying to get access to a part of history, which is otherwise really quite difficult to get at. So in the absence of any written records from Indian rebels and ordinary people who were for the most part illiterate and didn't leave any records, written records of their own, we really have to rely on whatever we can through the colonial archive. And rumors is one of the things that the British, they would record. And they might perceive it as sort of exaggerated news or gossip. But in reality, it actually offers a glimpse into sort of the mindset of ordinary people in the sense that it both reflects fears, especially when it's rumors that causes panic. But there's also an element of rumors in which there is hopes and aspirations that are being expressed. And so it actually provides you some kind of a glimpse into how people made sense of sort of chaotic events and the way that, you know, the life and world around them was turned upside down.
Excellent. So some of our listeners may not be that familiar with the specific history of the Raj. Can you please give us just a general rundown of the mutiny of 1857? And I'm also interested in the various terminology regarding the events of 1857, mutiny, rebellion, revolution, what have you.
So in the British context, you refer to the mutiny of 1857, which was arguably the biggest anti-colonial revolt of the 19th century. Mutiny, of course, has connotations of sort of an illegal or somehow not politically legitimate act of betrayal, really. And in India today, the uprising is described as the War of Independence, and in some cases even revolution. So it's a very, very significant event, both within a British colonial history, but also in an Indian context, where Indian nationalists of the 20th century, as they struggled for independence, would refer back to 1857 as sort of the first moment that Indians, they picked up arms and tried to achieve independence. It is of course problematic to impose an anachronistic interpretation. And that there was no real sense of a nationalist struggle in 1857. And it was largely limited to the northern parts of India. So by no means did it sort of encompass the entire subcontinent or even India as it is today, exists as a nation state.
And so the British, in sort of a delegitimizing way for to sort of downgrade potential nationalist aspirations, refer to it as the mutiny to make it seem like a criminal act as opposed to a politically organized revolt with an agenda, correct?
Yes, and it did start amongst the Indian troops in British service. And so it was, technically speaking, a mutiny, at least to begin with. But very quickly, it spread to the general population. And the Indian rebels and the mutineers, they flocked around the banner of the erstwhile Mughal emperor, who was at that time based in Delhi. And so there's no, it doesn't make sense to talk about a mutiny when you have the last Mughal emperor actually leading, at least nominally, the uprising. And so I would, the terminology that I use is uprising or rebellion, which are descriptive rather than really political.
Right. So these troops that are revolting in this mutiny or uprising are the sepoy army. Who were the sepoys? And can you tell us about their composition, the religious background? What sort of religious issues did this army face? Who ran the army and its relationship to the British Crown and the British East India Company is always a little perplexing for people outside of this field of specialization.
Yeah, so right up till after the uprising, 1859, it wasn't British India. It was the East India Company that actually governed India. And it's only in 1859 that it becomes a crown colony and the jewel in the crown. So it was run by the East India Company, relying to a large extent on locally recruited soldiers. I mean, it's one of the key things of Western imperialism, that it cannot actually exist without local allies. And that's not just the British Empire, it's not just British India. It's a key feature of Western imperialism. And so the British were, during the 18th century, as they expanded their hold of India, they were competing with the French at the time, but also various local rulers and different powers. And it's the distance was simply too far to rely exclusively on white British troops, and there are not enough British people at that point of time. And so the British would recruit local soldiers, and in order to compete with their other political rivals, they had to offer advantageous conditions. And so that meant the British actually ended up recruiting and then establishing what was a high status and high caste army, which was dominated, but not exclusively, by Hindu Brahmins. The Hindus were, infantry was mainly composed of Hindus, whereas the cavalry was mainly Muslims. And so the British would, on the one hand, try to impose sort of a European standardization in terms of uniforms and drill and these kind of things. But at the same time, they also had to maintain the loyalty of what was effectively mercenaries. The Indian sepoys had no allegiance or sense of loyalty to Britain or the East India Company, but they did have a sense of belonging within their regiments. And so there is this sort of tension between the British attempt at creating a modern army where, you know, it has modern drill that uses modern arms, and at the same time respecting the religious sensibilities of their Indian soldiers. And in many ways, the British, they actually were tried at least to accommodate a lot of local practices and not offend or alienate the troops upon whose support their authority in India really relied.
Right. And so what are some of these religious issues between the British who are running this army and their soldiers, but also between the different groups of soldiers? I mean, there's a Hindu community, there's a Muslim community. Within the Hindu community, there's going to be caste variation, even though it's, as you said, dominated by upper caste Hindus. But how did these religious and cultural conflicts amongst these groups sort of play out in the functioning of the army?
So one of the ways the British they managed to run things was to establish a very homogeneous army, and the irony is that they thought that they were observing high caste practices and letting their soldiers observe traditions, but as the British were gradually expanding their control over India, they were disbanding all the local armies. The East India Company army actually became the only place in which high caste Brahmin military traditions survived. So not only were the British recruiting, this is the only real place you could find service as a soldier, but that also became the only place that you could maintain a sort of high status identity. One of the things that the Brahmins they insisted on was strict vegetarians. They don't eat in a mess. They cook their own food. They don't cross the sea, which was perceived as sort of a superstition, and they were black for what was known as the Black. They were afraid of what was known as the Black Sea. What the high caste fears of crossing the ocean is actually about being separated from your family, being far away from the holy river Ganges, which means if you die on the battlefield, your ashes can't be spread in that river if you are far away. But also simply if you're on board a ship, you're not actually able to prepare your own food. You would have to accept food prepared by someone else whose caste and status you can't really ascertain. So there are a lot of little sort of technical details pertaining to everyday ritual practices that the British, they actually really tried for a long time to accommodate. But then you have throughout the latter part of the 18th century and into the 19th century, you have conflicts, you have tensions coming up. And there are a number of smaller mutinies when, especially the Hindu sepoys, they break out and they refuse to follow orders as the British are slowly beginning to try and impose greater uniformity.
So some of the listeners may be familiar with the story of the Enfield rifle that was coated with, had bullets that were coated with animal fat. Can you speak to the legend of this off-sided tale?
Yeah, so the British, they introduced a new Enfield model 1853. And it's a new, it's an improvement of the Brown Bess, essentially. It's a paper cartridge, so there's powder and the round ball in a paper wrapping that simply makes it easier to load. But in order to ram down this paper cartridge, it has to be lubricated. And so when the British were about to introduce a new rifle to these sepoy regiments, a rumor began that the lubrication was made of the fat of pigs and cows, which would be highly offensive, not just to the Hindus, but also to Muslims. And the context in which this rumor becomes plausible is an increased presence of Christian missionaries and the British who have so far sort of observed a non-interference policy have slowly began to interfere more in Indian society. The East India Company as a trading company has become a colonial state trying to ban widow burning, for instance, but also in other ways sort of penetrating into Indian society, applying different types of taxes, and in many ways transforming India. By 1857, the British, they have been the de facto sovereign power on the subcontinent for more than 50 years. So life is changing. And since the British are perceived as essentially being Christian rulers, the position of the high caste Hindu sepoys in particular gradually becomes untenable. And then the rumor of the bullet becomes sort of the final straw.
And do we know for sure if these bullets were greased with either pig or cow fat?
We don't actually. The British at the time themselves did not know it. But the key thing is no sepoy was ever actually given these greased cartridges. So there is actually no...
They were never actually deployed.
They were never actually handed out to them. And the moment that the British, they became aware that this was causing such alarm amongst their troops, they allowed the sepoys to apply their own grease, which was beeswax and coconut oil. But the very fact that the British, they changed practice and all of a sudden allowed the sepoys to do it themselves, in the eyes of the sepoys, made it suspicious, because if there was nothing wrong with them, why would they then change procedure? So the very existence of the rumor also speaks to the growing distance between Indian soldiers and the British officers and rulers more generally.
Right, right. Yeah, that's fascinating. So Alan Begg, the character of this book, is, as it says in the title, a rebel of 1857. And the book is about his skull. And you explain in the beginning of the book how you came to be the keeper of the skull of Alan Begg. Would you tell us this story about your own personal encounter with this history?
It's one of those instances that all historians, they dream about. And when it comes, you just have to seize the opportunity. So I received an email in 2014 from a couple just outside of London who said they had a skull in their possession, which had been handed down in the family. And it was supposed to come, you know, have some or originate in the uprising of 1857. And so the story was that the skull was found in a pub in 1963, and inside the eye socket of the skull, there was a small piece of paper which gave the name of the man to whom the skull once belonged, Alan Begg, who was supposedly a rebel of 1857. But it also gave the names of the Scottish missionaries that he was alleged to have killed, as well as the Irish officer who was present at his execution. And Alan Begg, he was executed by being blown from a cannon strapped to in front of the barrel and blown to pieces, which was a technique the British used as they suppressed the uprising of 1857. And so supposedly the head remained intact and the skull was taken back to Britain by this Irish officer. And so I ended up taking the skull back with me, and I promised, you know, I would try and do some research on the provenance and also find out what to do, what should happen with the skull, because this family, they basically didn't want to have the skull anymore and they didn't know what to do with it. So I ended up with it.
And how were you able to verify that this was a skull from mid-19th century India? I don't know much about the science of skulls, but how did you go about verifying that this was, it was plausible that this note was accurate?
Well, the story as it was told in the note panned out when I did some more research. So the names of the missionaries who were killed allowed me to identify where the outbreak took place, namely a small cantonment town on a Sialkot, which is today in Pakistan. So the facts given in the note panned out. And then I took the skull to a natural history museum in London. And I've also later had forensic scientists examine it. And they confirm, as far as possible, the age of the skull, but also the age of the man to whom it belonged. I have not had DNA mm-hmm. tests done, but they would also be meaningless unless you had a sample to match it with. But everything, in a sense, pans out in terms of verifying the story.
And the officer, the Irish officer that's mentioned in the note, were you able to verify that he was in India about this time?
Yes. I actually found the diary of one of his fellow officers who describe their regiment being present at the execution of sepoys, which matches up with the story. And the officer then resigned a month later and went back to Ireland, and he would then have carried the skull with him. And actually, after the book came out, I was contacted by the family of the officer, and they knew of the story, but their version was that he was so disgusted by the British atrocities in India that he resigned. So they were quite shocked to find out that actually, he had himself taken a trophy skull home with him.
Oh, so the family had not known that he had taken this this trophy home. Fascinating.
No, and so the family members actually came to London and apologized in person to the skull, which was a quite moving experience.
Wow, that's fascinating. And of course, all your training in graduate school prepared you for these type of situations, verifying human remains and dealing with the descendants of people who've involved in these acts, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, for the first time, I actually had to think very, very hard about what it was I was doing, even writing the story and writing, you know, the book. I did a lot of research about how do you do this respectfully? How do you treat human remains so that it doesn't just become some kind of prop that you're essentially exploiting? But I tried to make that very clear in the book that my aim is to restore some of the humanity to Alan Beck, because the very way in which he was executed and then later turned into a trophy was, you know, was done in order to dehumanize him. And so I'm not particularly mushy or sort of I'm fairly cynical, but I do feel some kind of responsibility for the future of Alan Beck.
Or having been in possession of his remains, absolutely. Well, so let's humanize him. What were you able to discover about the life of Alan Beck? I mean, he's not a household name, right? He's an average soldier, perhaps. And who was he? What did he do? What was his role? And why was he executed in this really grisly manner?
So one of my key problems in writing the book was that I never actually found his name in the archive. So the only place I have his name spelled out is on the note that came with his skull. So in many ways, the book is about the note as much as it is about the skull. So what I did was I sort of created what I've described as a Frankenstein biography, where I relied on the other information that we do have about Indian sepoys from this period. And he was a Muslim who had fought for the British for a number of years and who then got entangled in these events as they sort of spun out of control during the summer of 1857. The sepoys, they break out at Sialkot. Not that many British civilians or officers are actually killed. But then the sepoys, they leave and they take the artillery and their arms and they move towards Delhi to join the other rebel forces. They're cut off along the way by one of these colonial heroes or anti-heroes, if you want, namely John Nicholson, who is an absolute psychopath. And they're essentially decimated.
Did you say an absolute psycho?
Yeah. William Dalrymple describes him as a great imperial psychopath. He was famously worshipped by some of his sort of Pathan followers on the northwest frontier. But he also talked about impaling Indians and flaying them alive as he was suppressing the uprising. So this is a particular brutal type of sort of muscular Christianity at play here. And during the battle at which Alan Beck and his fellow rebels were sort of cut off, there's an account of Nicholson cutting sort of the last sepoy standing with his sword, cutting him in half. And the survivors were either driven into a river and drowned, or they were handed over to the Sikh troops who were loyal to the British and essentially executed or tortured to death. But there were a handful of these would-be rebels who survived and who fled into the mountains of Kashmir. It's in the foothills of the Himalayas. And Alan Beck was among them. And they actually made it all the way through the mountains to the border with China, where they were turned back. It's a border to with Tibet, but it's governed by China at this point in time. And they were actually turned back by Chinese authorities and handed back to the British. So a year later, Alan Beck is taken back to Sialkot, the scene of his alleged crimes, where he's executed in this very exemplary manner. One of the things I did find out during the research of the book was he was actually innocent. He did not kill those missionaries. And I know that because it was somebody else who was very clearly identified as the murderer. So Alan Beck was strapped to a cannon and blown to pieces for crimes he didn't commit.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can you say a few words on trophy taking, this practice of taking human remains, in this case the skull, from the battlefield and taking it back to Europe? How common was this in the history of colonial warfare? Are there other examples? And is this a racialized practice? Does race factor into this history?
So trophy taking, when we think about it today, is often associated with sort of irrational behavior and rogue individual soldiers sort of taking things into their own hand, being traumatized by the death of their comrades and then mutilating the enemy. And it took place on a large scale during the Second World War in the Pacific against the Japanese, but also in Vietnam in the second half of the 20th century. In the 19th century, it was far more common than we usually think. And one of the reasons is that trophy taking as sort of a personal act that reflects on the masculinity of the colonial soldier, it also sort of overlaps with taking souvenirs. But it's almost impossible to distinguish between the scientific collection of skulls for scientific and therefore rational purposes. And of course, this is a period of time in which phrenology and craniometry are accepted sciences. It's almost expected of colonial officers, not just within the British Empire, but all sorts of Western explorers, travelers to Africa, Australia, to collect specimens. And it is very much racialized because in the mid-19th century, certainly before and also long after, indigenous people are quite often not recognized as fully human, but rather seen as part of the natural flora. So if you collect specimens of exotic flowers and animals, birds, monkeys that you stuff and send home, you've discovered new species of this or that. In much the same vein, you would also send home a skull of a local, whatever they might be. And that was fully acceptable, that was socially acceptable and even respectable practice. But then you also have colonial military personnel who literally, I mean, sometimes they kill people in order to get at their heads. And there's a trade in skulls. And one of the things I try to show in the book is that there's actually very little difference between somebody collecting a skull for his personal gratification or for putatively scientific purposes. The assumption is that a skull has some kind of intrinsic value and owning a skull is meaningful and a sensible thing to do.
Mm-hmm. But in warfare amongst European powers, would this be a common practice? Was there skull taking in the Napoleonic Wars in Europe or in the Franco-Prussian War?
No, I mean, that's one of the key defining traits of colonial warfare. It is very much racialized. You don't collect, you don't desecrate the enemy body when that enemy looks like yourself and when you respect them as being equal to yourself. It does happen on a small scale during the American Civil War. But there's some instances recorded of that, which again might have things to do with race. But of course, in the Indian Wars against the Native American people, human trophies are taken all the time, and of course the practice of scalping is an example of that. It's something that's really quite interesting because headhunting is one of the most emblematic practices associated with savages. And yet, when we look at it historically, it's actually the Western power. It's a white man who is the headhunter, if we look more closely at it. The idea is that taking a skull and putting it on your mantelpiece or putting it in a exhibition case in a museum is rationable. And even enlightened, but in fact, it's little different than a headhunter in New Guinea taking a skull from an enemy he has slain and taking it home.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that the two examples from American history that you gave are of wars in Asia, in the Pacific Theater against the Japanese, and then in the American War in Vietnam.
Absolutely. And I don't think that the racial aspect is really, I mean, there's no way that's absolutely central to the story. There are also the American fighting in the Philippines in the early 20th century. There are also records of skulls being taken. One thing we have to remember is that museums in America and Europe are crammed full of human skulls. And they used to be taken from criminals or the destitute and poor in the late 18th and early 19th century. But with racial science and European expansion into the non-Western world, it is non-white people whose skulls are taken on such a scale that actually some indigenous people, they started noticing it. And we have an account from a Dutch trader who was talking to the Zulus who were fighting the British in the late 19th century, 1879, during the Second Zulu War. And these warriors, they actually asked the Dutch traders, why are the British collecting our heads? Are they making some kind of medicine or is it a present to their queen? So it's not as if this is something that happens once in a while. These are not exceptional examples. It's actually quite systemic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And can you speak to the violence of the execution? You mentioned that these Alembeg and the other accused rebels are tied to cannons, and the cannon is fired and blasted through their body. What's the purpose of such an elaborate form of execution? Why not simply cut their heads off or shoot them in front of a firing squad? And who was there for these executions?
So there is a wide range of execution techniques that the British they use. I mean, it's an absolute slaughter as they're suppressing the uprising, and they would hang people left and right, and also just shoot people at the side of the road sometimes. But the execution by cannon really becomes crucial in reestablishing British authority. It's originally a Mughal practice, and it's very explicitly intended to deprive both Hindu and Muslim funeral rites because the body is destroyed, so you can't bury or burn people. So it's a culturally specific type of spiritual warfare, really, that's aimed at preventing the afterlife. And again, you see, this is the British are supposed to be the civilized people here. But the logic is that the only language that Asians understand, South Asians in this instance, is that of violence. But it's not just any violence. So it has to be culturally specific, which is one of the defining traits of colonial violence. You can't, hanging them is not enough. Just shooting them is not enough. It has to be something that speaks to their cultural sensitivities. So you can almost talk about an orientalization of colonial violence in this context. And at this, I mean, it's not something you don't blow people from a cannon in private, so to speak. It is intended as a spectacle. So what the British, they would do, they would line up the other Indian regiments to watch this, as well as local Indian villagers. And they would sometimes literally have the innards and remains of their comrades blown into their face, you know, covered in a shower of burning flesh, as a warning. Because this differs from the European ritual of public execution, where the audience, there's also an audience in hangings, for instance, but the people, the spectators, are supposed to acknowledge the justice of the execution that takes place. In the colonial context, all non-white people were perceived as potential rebels, and therefore the message of the execution was aimed at everybody. So in some ways, it becomes quite clear the British don't really care who is executed, because what really matters is that there is this sort of a message of pure force, a brute force that signals that the British are in charge, and this is what happens if you challenge colonial rule.
And what could you speak to the violence of this challenge to colonial rule? What was the violence of the mutiny? The note claims that Alam Beg had killed some British missionaries, correct? Both male and female. What types of violence did the rebels of 1857 engage in, and how was this violence perceived by the British?
So the kind of violence that occurred against the British in 1857 and against European civilians was in some way similar to that which you see during slave rebellions in the U.S. In the earlier 19th century as well. It is brutal and indiscriminate in many ways. So men, women, children are killed, sometimes burned alive, sometimes butchered. The assumption is, and this is where race against comes into play, was that if white women had been murdered, they had invariably been raped before. And whether there was any evidence of that is beside the point. The British perceived white women being subjected to any kind of violence by dark-skinned men that turned it into a threat of sexual violence, which was an affront to white male masculinity. And therefore, the response became this sort of almost insanely exaggerated response. It is really the nightmare scenario of the colonial world, that of vulnerable white women being subjected to what the British also imagined to be the sort of sexual desires of savage, decadent Orientals.
And that has so much resonance with the history of racial violence in the United States, for example, lynching and the rape anxieties and so forth. So you wrote in the book, this book was written not just against the grain, but also against the scarcity of evidence. What did you mean by this? And what problems did you face trying to source this material and do this research?
Well, as I mentioned, I never actually found Alam Beg in the archive, I searched far and wide in archives in India and in the UK, and his name was never there. So I always had to struggle with this sort of silence, the man whom I was writing about, I did not have any of his words. What I did have was his skull, which is ironically more tangible than his recorded words in some ways. So I had to make a very conscious decision that I would never actually be able to recover his voice. But I did find it a really interesting challenge to sort of flesh out what would the experiences, what would the history have been, not of a rebel leader or celebrated Indian ruler who, you know, led the rebellion, but what would it have felt like to be an ordinary Indian soldier who got caught up in this crazy whirlwind? Because the fate of Alan Beck is very much one of an outbreak, attack on the British, and then they flee towards Delhi, but then are driven into the mountains. The survivors actually wander around the Himalayas for a year before they are caught. So it's a story which doesn't fit easily within the conventional narratives about either heroic colonial derring do or anti-colonial nationalist heroes. And I thought that was a really interesting challenge. Some of the things that I used was the letters that sepoys would send to each other before the outbreak happened, where they would sort of say, what are you guys going to do? We hear there's been an outbreak here, and you know, this other regiment says we should join them on this and that date. So there's all these sort of, again, rumors, even as the outbreak is happening, about, you know, who's going to blink first, who's going to take the next step. And in many instances, it's actually how the British respond which determines whether or not the Indian sepoys remain loyal. And the issue of loyalty and betrayal is crucial here, of course.
Yes. And you write in the book, my particular take on the events of the Indian uprising will not appeal to everyone. And for those who prefer their Raj nostalgia or Indian nationalist mythology unchallenged, there are literally hundreds of books that will provide reassuring and politically edifying narratives. This book is not one of them. So what is your particular take on the uprising, and how does it fit into this historiography, which you indicate can oftentimes be polarized between Raj nostalgia and nationalist mythology?
Well, history is so often written not just by the victors, but also within particular political contexts, which come to overdetermine them. I obviously don't have much time for Raj nostalgia, but I also find the response, which you still see amongst many Indian writers today, or at least in the sort of popular imagination, is a rosy-tinted one of these sort of Robin Hood characters breaking out, where in many ways facts and the complexities and nuances of the past are lost, as events such as the uprising of 1857 is yoked to a very particular agenda. And so that was something I was very keen to avoid. I mean, there's this huge literature about these events. But there is something I've noted, is that the better known events are, I think I want to call it something like the Titanic or the D-Day effect. The more books that have been written, the more certain stereotypes and falsehoods are perpetuated, because there's just such a body of literature that historians rarely go back to scratch. They always build on what's already there. And so what I always try to do is sort of almost deliberately ignore the historiography and really bury myself in the archive and try and get a more immediate sense of how one might reconstruct the past. It might be a slightly idealistic approach, but I find it, when it's particularly events that are very sort of heavily imbued with political significance, it helps very explicitly and deliberately trying to sidestep the politics.
That's fascinating. So, Did you receive any pushback on this book and on your depiction of 1857, either from proponents of Raj nostalgia or proponents of an Indian nationalist mythology, as you phrase it?
Surprisingly, very little. I think the fact that the story was about one man and about one man's skull kind of made it really difficult for any conservative people to sort of argue that, you know, I was trying to demonize or somehow malign Western imperialism. The story, in a sense, speaks for itself. And I've only received very positive feedback, really, from an Indian context, because this is in a way a forgotten part of the history of India and of the uprising, and I've sought to provide some kind of humanity or show at least some light on, you know, somebody who fought was what is perceived to be a war of independence, and so far it's been positively received.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I had the pleasure of teaching it in a graduate seminar last year, and my students loved it. So, well, you won over 15 Americans. Where is Alam Beg's skull now, and what do you hope to do with it, to see what happen?
Alam Beg's skull is in a museum box in a cabinet right next to me. I'm still the custodian of the skull. And what I wanted to do, I want to write the book in order to bring some attention to the story so that he could be repatriated. And so my aim has always been to return him to India and to provide him with a respectful funeral, and to some extent put an end to this story, because when you take a trophy skull, you're depriving the individual of any kind of closure. And again, I'm not particularly superstitious or anything like that, but since I took custodianship of the skull, I do feel it is my responsibility to bring some kind of closure to this story, and repatriation is the obvious way as far as I'm concerned. My biggest worry is that, you know, he would end up in a museum somewhere or a storage room. So the key issue now, and I'm working with the Indian institutions as well as British ones, is a physical transport of actually bringing Alam Beg back to India. You can't just take a skull in your suitcase and go home. Well, you could conceivably, but I don't want to really be stopped by airport security.
Yes, that could prove a little problematic. Does the current political situation in India pose any problems here with the rise of the BJP and Modi's Hindu nationalism? Alam Beg was a Muslim. Does this play into tensions within India or India-Pakistani tensions?
Well, Alam Beg is not the most obvious patriot to repatriate. And so I've actually received very little attention from official Indian hold, which is fine with me. But he is unlikely to be celebrated the way other explicitly Hindu figures are. In Pakistan, the events of 1857 don't really figure that large. They don't loom large sort of in the nationalist or the national narratives. So the obvious place of repatriation is India.
Is India?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as we get ready to wrap up, I was wondering if you could say a few words on the popular view of empire in today's post-imperial Britain, and how do memories of empire resonate with certain issues in British politics, say Brexit and Britain redefining its place in the world today.
You brought up the B word. this book was written in 2016, so it is very much in the shadow, not just of Brexit, but also Trump. Empire in Britain.
The T word.
Sorry?
The T word. Sorry. Yes. They'll edit that out. You can start over.
Yeah. So the debates that are taking place in the UK today is very much about the legacies of the empire and whether or not people should feel pride or shame, which is not a particularly useful way of looking at the past. And much like the calls for the removal of statues of Confederate generals, you also have calls for the removal of statues of Cecil Rhodes, for instance. And what it really comes down to is a kind of identity politics. So any kind of historical exploration or studies that focuses on colonial violence, slavery, economic exploitation are perceived as being explicitly anti-imperialist and therefore product of the left. And there's a certain generation and a certain British people who still think fondly of the empire, who really dislike what I would simply describe as scholarly studies of imperialism. So it is in many ways far more politicized than it has been before, this kind of work. And the interesting thing is I don't perceive this book as a work as critique of British rule in India. I think if you read it and you walk away thinking that the Raj was some unfortunate incidents happened, but by and large it was a force for good, I've obviously failed. But I don't feel it's necessary to say this was a bad thing or that it was a good thing. I think these labels are too easy, and they lend themselves too easily to a kind of politics which are not conducive to historical understanding. But again, I think the fate of Alan Beck speaks for itself. British rule in India was indisputably based on a racialized logic and in some instances extreme and extremely brutal violence.
Yeah. Well, Kim, we've taken up a lot of your time. But before we go, let me ask you about what comes next. Now, I noted earlier that you have a book on Amritsar 1919, which actually just came out on this the centennial of Amritsar. And I hope to have you back to discuss that book. But as a way to finish this conversation, will you please tell us what else you are working on? I know that at one point you were very interested in the American experience in the Moreland, the Muslim-majority islands of the southern Philippines. Is there a book on this project in the works?
Yes, there is. I mean, I've gone from bad violence to more bad violence, only this time it's American. So yes, I'm working on a project on the colonial origins of the war on terror. And I take the T word. I take Donald Trump's anecdote about General Pershing and the use of pig's blood against Muslims as sort of the framing anecdote. A lot of American historians have argued that this never happened, but the fact is that it did. And the American troops who did use pig's blood were actually inspired by events such as those I've just described in the context of the British suppression of the uprising of 1857. So it's actually part of a much bigger story of trans-imperial expertise in violence. So I'm in this book, I'll be challenging notions of American exceptionalism as much as British exceptionalism when it comes to empire.
Well, that sounds fantastic, and I look forward to seeing that in print. So, Kim, thank you so very much. It was a real pleasure to talk with you, and I hope that we get to chat again soon about your various projects.
Certainly was, and I hope we'll talk again.
Okay, thank you so much. Again, this was an interview with Kim Wagner regarding his book, The Skull of Alam Beg, A Rebel of 1857. My name is Michael Vann, and this was a podcast from New Books in History on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.